What is up, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Beyond, where we go beyond the average interview with the world's greatest cultural and creative entrepreneurs making waves in the world today. I'm your host, Chris Hall. Thanks, everyone, for watching that last episode, which was the first, if you missed it, with Jonathan Andrews, creative director for Migos and more. Super happy with all the feedback you guys are giving me. Appreciate that. Appreciate everyone listening on Spotify, YouTube, and podcasts. Like you guys know, it's available wherever you want. It's optimized for audio, but you can check out what we're doing in the studio on YouTube. However you want, if you guys want to get it, it's fine. Today we have a really special guest. His name is Jesse Lakes. He's the CEO of Genius Link. Genius Link is a company that routes links and optimizes affiliate links worldwide for everyone from the world's biggest companies to the individuals that we know here on YouTube. And it's a really special story about how a guy from northwest of America growing up in kind of on a farm or something like that made it all the way to Apple, and now he's the CEO of this company here. It's extremely interesting. We go over really how the internet works as a whole. I mean, links are the glue that hold the internet together, and this guy is processing hundreds of millions, if not billions, of them a month through the systems that they built at Genius Link. We talk about, you know, his experience at Apple, where, you know, he was an employee at Apple running their affiliate program for iTunes right before Steve Jobs died, and he was at the memorial for Steve Jobs and left just soon after that. We talk about what that was like. There's really a lot that goes on beyond the consumer level of the internet, and we get very deep into it. So it's extremely enlightening. If you're interested in that stuff, I think you guys are really going to enjoy it. Like I said, this is available on YouTube and podcasts as well as Spotify. I want to thank, like always, I want to thank Be in Nature helping me set up this podcast. All my link is in the description on YouTube or in the podcast. I have my whole gear list there if you're interested. I also want to thank Hint, because I love Hint and drink it all the time, and they stock the studio, so when I have interviewers come in, they can have some nice fruit water. I drink it all the time, and they were lucky enough for them to partner with me on this. So yeah, we'll get right into it. If you want to hit me up for any reason, email me, chris@kickster.com, or just leave a comment on YouTube or DM me at chrishallnyc on Instagram. Thank you very much for watching, and let's get into the interview. Hey guys, welcome to Beyond. We're here with Jesse Lakes. Thanks for being here, man.
Absolutely, real pleasure.
So I've known Jesse for a while now, but there's kind of a lot that goes kind of beyond that, I think. And a lot of things kind of behind the scenes that people don't know in general about, like, tech or about software and about kind of your route to getting here, because B2B is like such a huge thing now. There's so much money in it, and also it's really the infrastructure of the internet. Like the internet is B2B basically, and, you know, in consumer products that we see is just like the surface level of it. So I want to ask you kind of, what is Genius Link today? And then we'll get kind of into your backstory and kind of what's going on behind it.
Yeah, sure. So just to riff off of what you said a second ago, you know, we live in the world of links, right? Intelligent link management is what kind of the tagline that we've given Genius Link. And links are really, you know, to riff off your analogy, it's the glue that holds the internet together, right? You know, B2B, you know, is absolutely right. The infrastructure to kind of put it all together. But our special world is that glue that, you know, connects Facebook to Twitter, YouTube to Amazon, whatever it may be. That link is definitely kind of the sweet spot where we've been focused. So yeah, Genius Link, intelligent link management. It's the idea that Bitly has done a great job kind of taking people to understand that a short link is really important for marketing. And we think Bitly has done a great job kind of in the content realm. But we feel that in the world of commerce, which is becoming a more and more important part of the internet, that you need something a little bit more more dynamic. The classic example I give everyone is Amazon is a great store for buying things. And Amazon.com is really optimized for us here in the US, US dollars, English language, prime shipping, et cetera. But someone in Germany doesn't want to buy from Amazon.com. They want to buy from Amazon.de, because Amazon.de mm-hmm. is in euros. It's got the German language.
Why does that even exist? Why does the German version exist?
Well, because Amazon wants to sell in Germany, and Amazon wants to sell in France, and Amazon wants
and
to sell
their native language. And
exactly. So, you know, you can have one storefront that, that sells around the world, but it's not going to do as good of a job as if you had those localized storefronts. So Amazon's done this great job, 14 different storefronts around the world, but they don't do any sort of geo-targeting. There are a lot of different e-commerce providers out there, a lot of different marketers don't do any sort of geo-targeting on their site. And that's a huge lost opportunity in a place where I think these intelligent
links. What's the importance of being on the proper version of the site beyond just the language barrier?
So language, currency, shipping, taxes, it's all these small things, right? You can, someone in Germany can absolutely buy from Amazon.com, and it has here in the US can absolutely buy from Amazon.de. It's just not easy, you know, and e-commerce is supposed to be as seamless as possible these days. So the more friction you eliminate, the more seamless it'll be, and the better off it is for the consumer and for you if you're an affiliate marketer.
And what's the relevance of links in general to the internet?
It's the glue, man. It's what holds it together. You know, HTTP, you know, hypertext transfer protocol, hypertext. Hypertext is just, you know, the long form of a link, right? It's what's there. HTML, hypertext markup language. Again, it's all about that hypertext. Hypertext, again, is just a link.
The hypertext is?
It's a link. That's all it is. It's, you know, URL that you know, puts it all together, creates that mesh that is makes the World Wide Web, the internet, so magical.
Right. So, briefly, where did you grow up and what was your first job and how did you end up working in tech?
Yeah. So, I grew up as far away from New York City as I possibly be in rural Montana. You know, four cars on the road was traffic growing up. So, you know, in the mountains, a handful of miles away from wilderness boundary, you know, my backyard was national forest. so very different. And it's always such a you know, contrast to come out to NYC and sincerely enjoy my time here. But I just grew up Western Montana, the Bitterroot Valley, and always kind of had a curiosity with tech. My dad was a newspaper writer, a journalist. So he would have a computer that you'd have to write his stories on. And, you know, he would show me kind of the very basics here and there and, you know, start off with the Apple IIe and then move to a, you know, 386 or something, and move back into the Mac world. But it was always so fascinating to see what you could do. Quick little tangent here. You had chores, right? You always had chores and you got an allowance. So at a point I started trading in my allowance for America Online access. So it was a long distance call because we were remote, but you know, my $5 or $7 a week or whatever became, yeah, an hour or two on the internet. And that really just kind of started.
Oh, that's insane.
It started this whole curiosity thing. And it's slowly kind of evolved from there. I've done a lot of non-tech jobs. You know, really my first real tech job was probably working with Apple on the iTunes marketing team. And that didn't come until I was, I think, 26, 27.
What was the job before that?
Before that, it was a combination of things, but my real day job was probably the whitewater rafting guide. And it's in my summers in Colorado as a raft guide. And then I'd go down to Costa Rica in the winter and work as a guide, help out a company down there. So
what'd you do there?
Mostly a bum, but I had kind of these.
You were doing rafting down there as well?
Yeah, more safety kayaking. Yeah, kind of helping out with
the. Why was that needed there?
There's some big rivers. There's some big rapids.
Okay, so you're like Coast Guard kind of.
More or less, yeah, exactly. Someone pops out, and I paddle up and grab them.
That's crazy.
It was super fun. It was a good lifestyle.
It's like a badass version of a lifeguard.
Yeah, exactly.
That people do in New York.
The lifeguards have to work harder sometimes, though.
When did you even think like, okay, I'm going to, I'm done with kayaking or how'd you get into tech?
Yeah. So
how'd you get interested in it as well?
So always, have you been, I've always been interested, always kind of dabbled around, you know, started building websites in high school. Tried to make some money off that. Yeah. Did not do very well in that. Always kind of had, I hate to call them companies cause they were never really that profitable, but always had little projects, building different websites. Had a blog, did a couple different little, you know, side things. Tried to do a hosting company with some of my roommates in
college.
What
were the websites about?
So the websites, the ones that actually, the first one was called Nifty Tricks, and Nifty Tricks was supposed to be the Bible of extreme sports, the idea that all your tips, tricks, techniques could be kind of compiled into one place. That was kind of during the .com era. I was a fresh sophomore, junior in college. It was the height of the .com era. Yeah, you know, I thought for sure that I had this idea that I could go sell all these, you know, $80 CPM, you know, ad buys on and be rich. And that was so far from the truth, but it was a great lesson just kind of in learning how to, you know, HTML, CSS in those early days. But the websites that really actually did something for me were a series of websites that took soundtracks from extreme sports films. So, you know, every year Warren Miller, you know, puts out a new film with 50 some odd songs on the soundtrack. I would take that soundtrack, list it out, and link to iTunes and Amazon. And that was the first website that actually generated some noticeable revenue. And that was
and
kind
what
of
what was the revenue stream on that?
It was primarily just the iTunes and Amazon affiliate programs. So that was, yeah.
What year was that?
So this is like 2006, 2007.
So is it even around back then?
Yeah, absolutely. Amazon's affiliate program has been around since, you know, late 90s. iTunes affiliate program, I believe, was introduced in 04, 05. I should know this, but yeah, a handful of years before my time.
So how did you get started at Apple?
So again, Apple fanboy, you know, it really,
we all are.
Exactly. Drank the Kool-Aid early on. I was actually a campus rep for Apple, in college. So, ended up getting connected with, the account manager, and we would, spend some time, you know, cruising around campus and helping kind of, introduce, it was at that time it was, you know, the iPods and, the iMac and so forth. So that really kind of wet my appetite. And then, you know, after graduating from college, ended up in Colorado, was the RAF guy, but always really liked the Apple products. It was a big fan. And then when I kind of built these websites to focus in on the soundtrack stuff, the iTunes affiliate program was just a natural fit. So spent some serious time really learning the iTunes affiliate program. Mm-hmm.
So you applied to Apple cold?
No, actually enjoyed the iTunes affiliate program. Thought it was, that was really cool. It was, it had a sincere lack of documentation, but it was making me some decent money at this point. So I started just compiling all these notes and actually wrote a book about the iTunes affiliate program.
Wow.
So, didn't go down to Costa Rica that winter, but just, yeah, put together these notes, put together this book. Right as I thought I was about to publish it, I sent a copy over to, some people I'd found on LinkedIn that were actually at iTunes and the marketing team.
Creative. But
I thought they were going to really appreciate it. They replied with a cease and desist, and start off this conversation. This one woman in particular.
I thought you were going to say they were going to hire you.
But. Well, they threatened to sue me first, and after this conversation, they offered to hire me. So it was a nice.
It's like if they can't beat you, they're going to join you.
Exactly. Awesome. So it was, yeah, it was a crazy difference to go from, you know, being a whitewater raft guy to having a cubicle and a commute and living in Cupertino. But it was cool. It was, again, I'd been a fanboy for a long time. It was something I was passionate about.
So what did you end up doing there?
So global product and, program manager for the iTunes affiliate program. So oversaw the affiliate program.
What is the iTunes affiliate program for people who don't know?
Yeah. Great question. So
I think most people don't know.
So let's take a step back. What is affiliate marketing? I think is the first question. Affiliate marketing is a way that, you can have a pseudo relationship with a company where they will give you a specially formatted link. And if you put that specially formatted link and talk about a product, and someone clicks on that link and then goes on to buy, you'll be rewarded for your effort. So it's relatively low risk for them. It's more higher risk for you compared to like a CPC or CPM ad buy. Mm-hmm. But it's a way for you to, like my website's promoted music. It was a great way for iTunes to get, traffic to buy music, you know, from a specially niche.
So
site.
If you were responsible for the traffic to iTunes, they would give you a 10% cut of it or whatever.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. And that was the affiliate program.
And this exists for Amazon is a huge one. It mm-hmm. exists for what else?
There's yeah, well over thousands of different affiliate programs. Hundreds of them that are decently sized, but yeah, most every major retailer has an affiliate program. Mm-hmm. I can't think of one off the top of my head that doesn't have an affiliate program, but I'm sure they're out there. But
so what was kind of a more detailed responsibility that you had, like optimizing the system or working with affiliates or what?
All the, so I wasn't, you know, this woman that, initially called me and we screamed at each other for 45 minutes before she offered me the job, ended up being my manager, and she's awesome. Still work with her a fair amount, but, she's a great marketer and she's a great manager, but she wasn't technical. And, I was, you know, this kid coming in with, you know, no corporate experience, no real job experience, you know, mm-hmm. RAF guiding and corporate America are two different things.
Yeah.
But I just essentially took over most everything on the technical side. She gave some high level, did the block and tackle from the political side to make sure that I had the room to do what I needed to do. And I just essentially took, you know, the book that I wrote about the affiliate program, laid out a couple of the challenges, and those challenges became my opportunity to fix it. And it was an amazing couple of years to have this woman really, you know, helping me out, mentoring me, but it was wide open, you know, do what you can to make the affiliate program better.
When you walked in there, what was it like? And kind of when you left, what was the difference?
While Steve Jobs was alive, and while, you know, I left shortly after Steve Jobs passed away, it was crazy. You know, I had nothing to compare it to. It was pretty magical. You know, you think of an Apple product and it's very shiny and so forth. So it was awesome being part of that. But you really start to dig in and you see that Apple is made up of a lot of individuals with a lot of passion, but because they're individuals, not everyone is perfect. So there's a lot of, don't get me wrong. Apple's an amazing company. I love them very much, but you start to peel away the layers and there's challenges. There's real, you know, there's dirt, there's, you know, things that are held together with baling twine and duct tape. It's not perfect all the way through, but because people really care about it and because such an emphasis is put on making sure that the final product is polished, it is. And it's great to be part of that, but there's real challenges. There's real politics. It's a real company. It's a real company that has something special, but it's made up of people.
So you might, in at least for the first year of this podcast, probably will be the highest level Apple employee I've ever had on. What was the, now you have seen Steve Jobs in real life, right?
Yeah.
You've worked with him.
Same company as him. Yeah.
Right. What was it like? What was the transition, you know, when he was alive to when he passed away? And I mean, you were at the memorial at Apple campus.
Yeah.
Like that's you know, that's something, especially for people in New York and non-California people, that's like a dream, like, you know, it's like we wish we were there type of thing. But what was it like to go through that transition, and what was the memorial like and everything like that?
Yeah, it was, it was always Uncle Steve, right? You know, Uncle Steve is kind of this fixture. And the iTunes offices were a little bit off campus, but, the main cafeteria, Cafe Max, where you'd go to lunch more often than not, was right in the middle of Infinite Loop. So Infinite Loop is a series of buildings that make a circle. Mm-hmm. Cafe Max is kind of right in the courtyard. It's a really cool building. The new building obviously is amazing. We'll talk about that later if you want. But so you, coming from the other buildings, you didn't run into Uncle Steve very often. But the warning was that the urban myth was you never wanted to be, you know, stuck within earshot of him. And his, I guess, I never had this happen, but he would ask, if you didn't know who you were, he would ask you what you do. And if you didn't have a great answer about how it was good for the company within 10, 15 seconds, he would fire you. This is urban myth, but so that was always the thing, is like, if you saw him coming, you may just kind of turn the other way. You did not want to get stuck in an elevator with him. So I definitely had a few times where I, you know, made sure that I, you know, either held the door for him or, you know, kind of got out of the way, but never really wanted to interact with him. That being said, I'll tell you another story here in just a second. But the general sense was, he was very focused. You know, he had his agenda and he was good to go. One of my favorite Steve Jobs stories from Cafe Max, so this lunch spot, is I'm going to space out the name here, that the previous president of Russia and his wife were visiting Silicon Valley and had a meeting with Steve. And, you know, these foreign dignitaries, you know, are very well dressed and have their bodyguards and so forth. And
they have manners.
Yeah, we'll get to that. So they're sitting. It's a beautiful California day. Yeah, they're outside on the plaza. Eating their lunch, and you know, the president is, or former president, his wife, are, you know, sitting, you know, with manners and so forth. And then right next to him is Steve at the same table, kicked back in his chair, feet up on the table. And it was just like, yeah, we were sitting two chairs over, or two tables over, just kind of glancing back and looking, just
not give you a fuck.
Exactly. I mean,
it's my house, bitch.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm Steve Jobs. Mic drop, right?
Yeah.
He had his own person. It was amazing.
Was he in conversation with the president?
Yeah. The president was there to talk to him about.
Okay, you know, he wasn't just next to him eating lunch.
No. But yeah, Johnny Ive.
And I heard, like, if he got into line somewhere, everyone would disperse.
Exactly.
Let him go.
My wife now, girlfriend then, was an iTunes engineer, and she would get sushi at Cafe Max regularly, and Steve liked his sushi as well. So, Shannon would, at one point, you know, felt someone like right behind her, looked around, saw Steve, and was like, oh, nope, not sushi today. And just disappeared.
And I'm sure, like, I just finished the Steve Jobs book as well.
Awesome book.
The audiobook by Walter Isaacson.
Yeah.
And after reading that, I would think that all those restaurants were like basically personally chosen by Steve, right? I mean, there's no way that would be there if it wasn't perfectly vegan and everything for him, right?
Exactly. So they did serve meat, not a lot of beef. In fact, hamburgers were, I think, believe I believe they were the only meat they served in Cafe Max on explicit requirements of Steve. You know, he had a, for all rights, he had, you know, he had a vision of what he wanted to see and it was molded around that. And everyone for the most part was happy about
it. About like, you know, he would go to a hotel with Johnny Ive and like Johnny would be waiting for him to call and be like, no, we're not staying here.
Right.
It's not designed well.
Yeah, exactly. you hear all the different stories of these products, these features that were, you know, built out to near completion. And then it'd go to review from Steve and
that could be like 50 people working on it, right?
50 people working on it for 6 months. You know, that's incredibly expensive from a company perspective.
Now we're just not going to launch it,
but it's got to be perfect.
Yeah.
Steve had a really high bar.
I think in the end, like that's probably the most valuable thing that he brought is taste, you know? And like, I think it's kind of undervalued now, even like that's really what's going on here. Like curation is the new creation in a way, you know? And like, if I could sit here and curate something for you and you don't need to go sift through it, it's valuable. And like Steve Jobs did that with ideas, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's, you know, he's criticized to some degree that he didn't have any original ideas. He was just combining the pieces of whatever the things, but that's exactly, you know, the iPod was the perfect curation of what made MP3 players great. You know, the iPhone was a perfect curation of what made a phone amazing. So I would completely agree that curation was definitely one of his strong spots.
After his death, though, obviously this must have had a personal effect on everyone to some extent. I'd be like, oh man, like, all right, what's going to happen? Like with Tim taking over, like I'm sure Tim's a great guy, but like he's not Steve. And like, what was there stress that you guys could feel and like people kind of not knowing what's going on?
Yeah, it was very palpable. So Steve, I forget the exact date. Steve, I was on vacation and came back like a day or two before Steve died. Then Steve died. And just, yeah, the company definitely moved to a very somber attitude. And it was about a 2 week, 2 weeks of silence, right? So I worked on the marketing team. And during that time, I don't believe anything on social media went out. Kind of all the marketing, you know, we dealt with fire drills, but we didn't do anything.
The website was like,
exactly. We weren't, you know, actively marketing. You know, it was just kind of a moment of silence, a moment of remembrance. And then the actual event, his memorial was crazy. So again, inside One Infinite Loop, the main building, you know, it's a courtyard. They had these great, huge signs with some of Steve's most popular quotes, which was...
There is a video that I saw. People can watch at home as well, but...
It was really powerful.
That's amazing.
It was really amazing. And reading the book and you know, kind of looking at those quotes and whatnot, it was the dude had a lot of pretty brilliant things. But it was that classic bittersweet that a good funeral is, good memorial is. You know, it's there was some esteemed people that came on damn on stage to speak. Coldplay was kind of the surprise, you know, audio visit. It was amazing. It's always amazing to watch them play. Steve had, I think, a special spot for Coldplay.
Yeah.
But it was sad coming into it, but you kind of felt better coming out of it. And just kind of this next chapter. I honestly, that vacation before Steve Jobs died, I had kind of in my mind agreed that it was time to leave Apple and kind of take this idea. It was originally GeoWrite, but GeniusLink idea kind of the next level. So
you probably weren't the only one who was like, I might be out too.
Well, so I'd kind of already made the decision. So I didn't stick around too much longer after Steve left. So I really didn't get to see much of Tim Cook's Apple. That being said,
what do you think about Tim?
I think he's a brilliant guy, but it's a different type of brilliance. I think Steve is Steve, and Steve, you can't, imitating Steve does a disservice to Steve and does a disservice to the company, I think. So
yeah.
If I remember this correctly, you know, Steve left pretty explicit instructions for Tim to run the company how he thought it should be best be run and not to run it how he thought Steve should try to run it, which I thought was smart. Wow. You know, everyone should play to their strengths. I you know, have been gone from Apple for a number of years now, but continue to stay in very close touch. They're great people. Obviously, do a lot with their ecosystem, help them out in a number of different ways. But I think the company is continuing to do good things. It's really hard to beat the iPod and the iPad and iPhone. Yeah. You know, Steve had some pretty amazing
things. Actually, one of my friends, Sam Sheffer, I was at his place the other day, and he had an original iPod.
Yeah.
Right after I listened to the book, and I'm like, whoa.
Yeah.
You know, I I actually got a U2 iPod for my like eighth birthday.
The black and red?
Yeah, like 10th birthday or something. I remember I was how psyched I was to get that. Yeah.
They were cool.
So how did going back to Genius Link, so mm-hmm. when you oh, actually I have one more Apple question.
Yeah,
what,
yeah, please.
What about what do you think of Johnny Ive?
So never met him, never really got to interact with him at all. But yeah, the guy's brilliant. Mm-hmm. It's the two of them were just the power couple. Right. And that was the thing, like Steve and Johnny were, you could always, if Steve was with anyone, it was typically Johnny Ive. So, yeah, I'm a huge fan of design is everything, right?
Yeah. You know, it seemed like they really locked down like the design department though. So they're kind of siloed in a way. Is that true?
Oh, so based off of, you know, you have your Apple badge, right? It has a big Apple logo and it has your face. And based off the color of the Apple and a few other things, which I didn't completely understand, you only had access to certain areas of certain buildings. And, you know, again, in one infinite loop, I had, you know, access to kind of the hallways to get me in and out of the central courtyard. But there were, yeah, you know, whole buildings that had no,
you never
exactly
even saw.
In the, you know, it's all blacked out. It's, secrecy allows surprise, right? And the surprise, that feeling of being excited with the surprise, I think was one of Apple's kind of trademark moves, right? If they can introduce a product that no one really knew about and just surprise, here's this thing that you can touch and you can feel and it's going to change your life. That's really cool. And I think that is a marketing move is just brilliant. And I think they really perfected that. So,
and it makes a big difference, but compared to the companies that, you know, it leaks and you know about it 6 months before it comes out and it's not so special anymore.
Yeah, all these speculations about this and that, whatever. Yeah, exactly. It's not as much fun. You know, it was always so exciting. You know, if Steve Jobs said, you know, one last thing, you know, and or one more, I forgot exactly what the line is there, but that was like
legendary.
Exactly. That's the excitement. You know, it's something amazing.
So your decision to leave Apple was, it seems like it was directly correlated with you wanting to start this kind of the seed idea of Genius Link. So how did that happen? And what was the origin kind of problem that you wanted to solve? And how'd you build the first version of Genius Link?
Sure. So take a quick step back to those soundtrack websites that I had. I had this nice exponential curve in my traffic to the website visits, but my revenue was very moving very slowly. It was not growing as fast. And that was kind of this big question mark. So the aha moment came when I realized that I had a lot of international traffic that was now coming to the website. And my oh no moment came shortly afterwards when I realized I was sending all that international traffic to just one storefront and it wasn't converting. So iTunes digital products, you can only buy from the iTunes store if you have a US-based credit card, US iTunes store if you're a US credit card. In Australia, if you have an Australian credit card, you can only buy from the Australia store. And that's, again, different silos, different countries because of digital rights management. So I was sending everyone to the US store. Someone from Germany or the UK or Australia wasn't able to buy with my affiliate links. So therefore I'd see the traffic on the website, but I wouldn't see the revenue from the mm-hmm. commission. So I wanted to, you know, again, kind of fix this. I wanted an intelligent link to figure out where to send someone to the best place to shop based off the location, et cetera. So we kind of built out the first prototype of that before I joined Apple. But while I was at Apple, it was a magical experience for me. I had an amazing manager. And part of the things I did while I was there was help to kind of expand the footprint of not only iTunes, but the iTunes affiliate program as well. So I was being paid well to make this problem worse. And that was just kind of a head scratcher. You know, I thoroughly enjoyed my time at Apple, met some amazing people, worked on some amazing projects, but I was just kind of seeing this from a firsthand perspective that user experience is broken and user experience is so important to Apple.
It wasn't using geography to route you to the right site.
Exactly. And at the same time, I've seen Amazon was increasing their global footprint as well and the exact same problem. So,
mm-hmm. And e-commerce as a whole is booming as well. So
exactly.
Everything's lining up.
Exactly. So it was a hard decision, but ultimately, you know, told my manager that would help her find a replacement and transition out is you know, the best way possible for everyone. And then kind of hit the ground running.
And what was the first vision for that first version? What was the vision for that first version?
So we wanted to it was focused solely on iTunes because that's what was the big problem for me and the big problem I've seen firsthand. So we wanted to combine, at that point, I think it was 19 or 24 different affiliate programs that ran on four different affiliate links or affiliate, sorry, 19, 20 affiliate programs, four different affiliate networks. Mm-hmm. And there was like four or five different media types. So we wanted to be able to provide just a single link that anyone in the world could click on. It was going to send them to that same content, that same song, app, movie, whatever it is, in their local iTunes store. And that was the beginning.
And how many clicks do you route today per month?
Hundreds of millions into the billions sometimes.
Into the billions.
Yeah. Seasonality is a big thing for us. Holidays are huge. February is a pretty slow month, but yeah, it's a big difference today.
For people who aren't familiar with, maybe they might be familiar with, consumer facing tech, mm-hmm. but how on the back end of tech, it's like a whole different, it's a whole underworld. It's like the iceberg kind of, the tip of it is what you see on the website, but yeah. It's like what's under the water is really what is going on. And in a lot of cases, you know, it's really the back end that takes almost all the work. It's like building systems takes work. Building websites is honestly like you can train a 6-year-old to build a website or like maybe not 6-year-old, but let's say 6th grader can build a website.
Absolutely.
But it's building those systems that takes so long and really the brunt of the work and like the intellectual work. So how does, you know, you can use your own company as example, but how does a tech product work in terms of what a stack is? You know, people hear full stack or half stack, mm-hmm. or what is a stack and kind of what's your stack and how does the whole thing work together to make this product that encompasses the front end and the back end and everything in between?
I think that the shortest answer is it's evolving. It's constantly changing. It's constantly, you know, there's newer and newer technologies that come online. We first started off, we were all in a MySQL database, and the MySQL database just was not able to scale with how our traffic was scaling, how the number of clients we were supporting, the number of links we were supporting was scaling. So, you know, what our stack looks like today is very different than our stack looked like when we first started. And
as it should be.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm sure it's going to change again as, you know, as we, you know, double and triple the amount of volume that we're passing through. But you're absolutely right. You know, to the end consumer for GeniusLink, they're going to see, you know, a gni.us/something link, right? That's mm-hmm. our footprint. But on the back end, it's a crazy amount of technology and servers and processes and really a hardworking rock solid team to keep all those pieces.
What's the database's significance in the system and what's the server's significance and its relationship to kind of the front end website that you could just go and visit?
Yeah. So it all plays so closely together. So for us, we need to have a link that resolves as quickly as possible and always resolves. So that's kind of like the fundamental
meaning
thing.
Loads.
Exactly. Yeah. You click on that link, it needs to go to that end destination, right?
And every millisecond counts in that situation.
Exactly. There's a direct correlation between how long it takes after clicked for the thing to load. So I'm going to butcher the numbers, but for every half a second, you lose 7% in conversion rate or something like that. So it's really, really important for us to ensure that everyone has a super fast experience and those links just don't time out. So,
and by definition, you're actually adding another step technically. So mm-hmm. you need to be super careful about
that. Exactly. Yeah. We want to add, we need to make sure we're adding value, not detracting value. So as a result, we have a global infrastructure. We use a series of different providers to have boxes, servers all over the world. We have a bunch of different geographically segmented servers. We have to make sure all those servers are able to communicate with each other. Each of those servers have mm-hmm. to be able to operate essentially independently in case something goes down. We actually have big racks in Seattle where we have local hardware. A lot of our bigger databases are to make sure we can store things. But in each of the different regions, we have a series of different databases as well to make sure, again, that they can operate independently, make sure they're operating quickly, et cetera. But there's kind of two different sides to it. One, we need to make sure that our clients have the reporting that they need to be able to make better decisions going forward. So there's a whole reporting side. On the other side, the databases are necessary to make sure that we can resolve each link to where it needs to be or to whatever rules it needs to be, right? If you're on this device, go here. Mm-hmm. If you're in this country, go there, whatever.
That's a major thing too, because now there's you know, mobile and then subcategories, iOS and Android. Then mm-hmm. there's web, then there's mobile web, there's tablet web, and all those need a different experience. And just like we're seeing now with, you know, some of the creators that you work with and I know, it can be a problem if you click a link and it doesn't open in the native app, but all the purchases happen in the native app, then you're losing out on that business. And like, I even when I tell people about your company, which I just do casually because it works.
Chris.
Yeah, of course. It's like kind of become a part. Honestly, GeniusLink has kind of become a part of the how to start up your YouTube channel monetization, you know, strategy. It really is. And like, you know, a simple way to describe it to people is like, if you're using, you know, Amazon's built-in affiliate tool, their mm-hmm. little bar at the top, and clicking that could work for US. But if you have 50% of your traffic outside the US, you're basically saying no to half your money.
Yeah, exactly. It's you know, first thing first with YouTube, we're off on a tangent now, but with YouTube, you know, You want to build a community. Your first thing is building a community, right? Adding value, right? Yeah. And once you start adding value, then it's time to start extracting value and making sure that it's a process that can be repeated. So affiliate links is a great process there. Once you have kind of an affiliate strategy in place, then your optimization is super important. And just as you said, if you have, you know, listeners, viewers, subscribers from all over the world, it only makes sense that you're helping add value to them so that when, again, they click.
And a lot of people actually underestimate that. Like even when we had, with the Kickster app, like we had like 40 or 50% international.
Yeah. The internet is worldwide.
And we weren't even trying to appeal to anyone else, you know, but I think that's kind of how it works across the board. Like
so many people speak English. So many people are fascinated with, you know, some of the things coming out of the US that, yeah, it's really easy to have international traffic that you just don't realize, but you got to monetize it or else you just leave money on the table.
Yeah. Yeah. So, how has it been to kind of meet the people who are using your product, and what's that meant to you?
So it means a ton to me. The reason I'm here today, honestly, and both a high level and a low level as well. It's our clients obviously pay the bills so that we can continue to operate and build cool new things. So being able to have a relationship, being able to, sit at dinner and enjoy, you know, food and conversation and be able to kind of dig in on what the problems are, what's working, what's not working is a great start, but also just having a relationship, you know, being able to understand who these people are so that we can kind of make sure that we're keep that in mind as we continue to build. Genius Link solved my problem that I had with my soundtrack websites 7 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. I'm no longer solving my own problem. And typically entrepreneurs, you know, start a business to solve their own problem. I've been fortunate enough to have been able to do that. So now it's time for me to solve my clients' problems. And I can't understand my clients' problems unless I understand my clients.
Isn't it crazy how you can, you know, have this relationship with a client, but like never meet them. And it's so easy to kind of forget there's a human on the other side, even though, you know, it's like, it's like when we had, you know, hundreds of thousands of downloads in our app, but I met someone in real life who used it. I'm like, what, you have the app? Like, you know, it's crazy. Isn't that amazing?
I feel very strongly that that's essential, that if you can't have that relationship, then you're no better off. We feel very strongly in having a human at the other end.
And for you, that since you're dealing with links, you know, hundreds of thousands of people a month potentially are having a touch point with something that you guys made.
Millions, hundreds of millions.
Hundreds of millions.
Yeah,
exactly. So I'm at hundreds of millions a month.
Exactly.
Even if it's just a little click, but you could mess it up for them if you're wrong on it.
I could ruin their day if that link didn't resolve. Exactly. Yeah. Taking just a quick step back, though, one of the things that I found that was most valuable for my time at Apple was actually being a person on the other end of the email for all the affiliates that were having issues. So I took client support incredibly. That was like my top priority. And I kind of learned from that point that if you... you know, you give a person to work with that builds a relationship. And I think that was really instrumental in my success at iTunes and some of the success of the affiliate program. So I really ensure that piece carried forward into Genius Link. That was really important.
What was the largest technical challenge or business challenge that you had at Genius Link ever?
we're constantly having, figuring out how to do Amazon link translation was one of the biggest challenges. iTunes was relatively easy because there was only five different product types. Amazon has so many different product types. So, you know, taking those basic building blocks of how we knew how to do this link translation and applying them to, you know, what works for shoes also needs to work for water bottles, which also needs to work for car parts. That in itself was a long process. And
how do your, without saying names, how do your clients kind of break down? Do you have some giants that represent a bunch that represent, you know, a third of your traffic? And then there's, you know, tens of thousands of other small people, or how many clients do you have in general?
So that's a great question.
I guess it's the same thing.
We call them clients. I feel like client is a it's a respectful thing, right? You know, we appreciate you're not a user, you're a client.
Yeah.
It's definitely your classic 80-20 rule to some degree. Yeah. The biggest clients push through the most traffic. Uh-huh. As far as raw numbers, in the thousands of paying clients, in close to probably 10,000s of people that are using either one of our side properties or we're able to get in when we had a.
And I think it's probably because you guys, you know, obviously if you guys have, you know, some of your clients are so big that if you made a mistake, it's a really big problem. But then at the same time, you also offer, you know, you can basically get started for free. So it's something that, like, I think that's a great model.
It's challenging, but I completely agree. We want to prove it, right?
Because people are already intimidated by this stuff. If they need to pay $50 a month to get started, that's even too high of a barrier.
We just spent 6 months doing a pricing rejuggle. We did a series of pricing tests over the fall and just pushed together new pricing a couple of weeks ago. And that was really hard because we do have some of the largest companies in the world as our clients. And you're absolutely right. We have people signing up that, you know, will maybe push 100 clicks in a month. You know, they're very small, just getting started. Yeah. And both of those are important to us, right? Yes. Yeah. The person pushing just a few clicks is, you know, not huge in the fiscal sense right now.
You might be helping them build their career.
Exactly.
You know,
and
they could be a big client later.
That's exactly it. You help them grow. You know, if we're doing our job correctly, we're helping you do a better job with, you know, if you're a YouTuber, if you're an author, if you're creating niche websites. But on the flip side, that person may end up, you know, working as the digital marketing strategist at a massive company. Right. So in my book, it doesn't matter if you pay us a little,
kind of,
pay us
if they know about your product, they kind of probably are, you know, educated on this stuff and interested and kind of nerdy about the links already, you know.
Well, we would hope so, and we will definitely do our best to I have no problem calling myself a nerd, and I love, you know, geeking out over the details here. And, you know, education is such an important part. You know, again, a link is the glue that holds the internet together. If you're not familiar with that, it can all fall apart. So,
and that's so important, because especially if you're like an up-and-coming YouTuber or blogger or anything that where you can sell through links, it's like you need to think of the internet as something where you put in an input and it can have long-lasting outputs. You know, you can make a video today and in 3 years it's still getting views, still getting clicks. So optimization becomes extremely important.
Exactly.
Like, literally, if you go, I know some people who, if they took a week, revisited all their YouTube videos, updated all their links to Genius Links and had the right affiliate links in there and everything like that, they could like triple their revenue without doing anything. And that's just shows you, like, optimization on that is so important because of that concept. Like, you do, you know, even you make a post on Instagram, it's going to get distributed through thousands of different phones on your behalf. Like, and it's that power. It's that power of the internet right there.
Exactly. But also understanding that power and making sure you harness and control that power as much as possible. Right. It's, you know, don't send everyone to one place. You know, that's great for Bitly and content, but for commerce, right, if you're actually promoting a product.
What do you think about, like, so much of the world's traffic now going through, you know, Google or Amazon or...
You're hinting in the conversation we started last night over dinner, which was, it's crazy.
And when I mean that, I mean Google's, you know, database software, AWS, server software, AWS, yeah. Amazon Web Services.
Exactly. I think there's pros and cons, right? It's awesome that some of these companies have figured out such a way to scale and to be able to provide access for people that are just getting interested in it, that don't need a DevOps person or someone that's, you know, built servers before to be able to compete with their peers that can be bigger than them. So being able to just kind of open doors and scale, you know, that's amazing. On the flip side, you know, when AWS goes down and pulls down Netflix and half the internet, that sucks. Maybe it's a good reason to go outside and play, but you know, the internet comes to a crashing halt. You know,
and you realize how fragile it can be.
Exactly. There's definitely some concern, and for exactly that reason, we don't use just one hosting provider across the board, because that, again, it's dangerous. Mm-hmm.
What's like the your personal lowest point as an entrepreneur, and like, when was it, and like, what can you look back on now and be like, I'm so glad I figured that out. And like, it made a huge difference.
So,
and what'd you do to get out of it?
Yeah. In late 2015 was hard. So GeoRiot, was the original company. We rebranded Genius Link in August of 2015. Mm-hmm. 2015 was a hard year for us because Amazon had asked us to change our revenue model, which was a real challenge. GeoRiot, we kind of outgrown that. We started this Genius Link thing. We had a real crisis of morale with the team. It was a team of eight or nine at that point. And just the team was starting to kind of fall apart. At the same time, my wife was pregnant. She's also a co-founder, our COO.
Right.
So I had a kid on the way. So it was really hard kind of coming into work, when no one was excited to be there. We had just tried this rebrand. Yeah, it was the early days. Things weren't great there yet. Mm-hmm. And I thought I wanted to step away from the CEO role. You know, I at least as a partially.
Wow, so you thought you were just ready to give it up for right then.
As a first time CEO, you know, I don't know what I don't know, but I was getting to the point where I didn't feel like I was really adding value. And felt like, in fact, I was kind of, you know, pulling value out. So we found a candidate, a guy that had previous experience, was incredibly smart, skilled, much older.
And how many employees do you guys have now
for reference?
14.
Yeah. So, we're bootstrapped. So no VC funding. So anything we grow, we have to do it on our own. So we're a little bit slower than some of the other startups you see on Silicon Valley or whatever it may be. But yeah, it was a pretty slow spot, or a pretty hard spot, pretty deep spot.
So you had stress from your partners, basically.
Stress. Well, not necessarily my partners were behind me, but the team.
I meant, you know, Amazon and those.
Yeah,
you know,
that was kind of earlier on. It was just 2015 was just a hard year in general, but towards the end there. But really just kind of came together as we found out we couldn't afford the CEO, and I said, okay, well, I'm going to take a month off, cause you know, my daughter's going to be born, and you know, my wife took a month off. We spent that, you know, that time really taking a break from the business, you know, kind of breathing again, came back. 2016 was an amazing year for us. Absolutely amazing year. So, you go from the bottoms, the lows to the highs.
That's how it is. Like, you know, life has ups and downs, and when you're living an entrepreneurial life, it's just more extreme.
It really is.
Down and further up.
Exactly.
That's kind of all it is. So what was, looking, you know, coming back to today though, what's kind of the major, you know, 1, 2, 3 things on the roadmap that you want to get out? And we'll wrap it up after that.
Yeah, for sure. So, again, going back to our conversation last night, we had this great dinner with a couple other influencers. Yeah.
Craig Adams, Alex Castro.
Yeah, had some great conversations. and mobile deep linking came up. And it's something we'd looked at a while ago and kind of passed on because from the few little tests we'd done with some of our clients, the situation that we had was honestly better for ultimately kind of the affiliate
revenue. So you click you're on YouTube mobile app in your iPhone, you click the link and we all wanted to go to the YouTube, the Amazon app, and not the site.
Yes and no. You wanted to go to the place where they shop at because where they shop at is where the cookie's stored and therefore the affiliate cookie we could reference so that you can show you could blah, blah, blah. So, you know, back to kind of what are the kind of top priorities. This mobile deep linking is something that's kind of come back up. That's quite interesting. So I think that deserves a solid test. It's not a crazy hard project based off the infrastructure we have. It's something that we hadn't exactly planned on, but I think it's, you know, based off this conversation,
that's a major thing,
something to think about. Outside of that though, we have a lot of eggs in our iTunes, Amazon, and Microsoft store basket, because that's where we've spent a lot of time optimizing our links to programmatically just work, automatically work, I should say. we think there's more opportunities outside there. You know, we know that B&H has a great affiliate program, Best Buy has a great affiliate program, Newegg has a great affiliate program, et cetera. And while we absolutely love Amazon, Amazon does a great job for an affiliate program, we know it's not the end all. And at the end of the day, we need to make sure that our clients have the tools they need to be independent and ensure that they can maximize revenue. As far as what's on the roadmap, there's a lot of great individual features, but ultimately we're focused on the core goal of helping our clients just be more independent, giving them tools to kind of just be a one-stop shop intelligent linking solution where they can really make sure that if affiliate monetization is important to them, they have all those tools. If just link management in general is important to them, the tools are there as well. So there's a couple bigger features to bring on other ecosystems and support them. Maybe not to the same level that we support Amazon. We've got a lot of custom dev work specifically for supporting the Amazon ecosystem, but there's a lot of other ecosystems that they could use some basic support and go a long way.
Yeah. And so what's the one thing that people can actually offer value to you personally right now if they wanted to be of help?
I love conversations, just networking, just hearing stories and hearing what they're working on helps. This came up at lunch today, actually. I'm going to butcher the quote, but there are no new ideas. It's just borrowing ideas from different areas and combining them. And that maybe even comes back to our whole Steve Jobs curation
right? Yeah.
As far as asking for help, I would just love to meet more people and just have more conversations.
It's always interesting to hear, like, you know, you made a product, but they're using it in a way that you never thought.
That happens to us all the time.
Right? Yeah.
And it's, this is probably a horrible example, but the people that got rich during the gold rush were not the gold miners, right? It was the people that made the jeans or the shovels, right? We want to be one of those, right? We're not going to build the next awesome app. We're not going to build the next awesome consumer app. We're not going to be the next best review site, but we want to provide those people with that tool. But when you build a shovel, you know, you build a great shovel, that shovel can be used for mining gold or shoveling horse shit, right? And different sides of the equation, but it's still the same tool. And that's really what we'd like GeniusLink to be, is just a very solid tool that people can do different things. Yes, we have a core focus, but
what's your kind of best advice for someone who's really interested in, you know, this type of, you know, linking, deep linking, B2B tech, like hard tech? What's your kind of best advice on kind of entering that if they're inspired by your story?
A good sense of curiosity. That's what got us to where we are today. You know, being able to poke at things and understand things and just curious about learning how they work is going to take you a long way.
Cool. All right. Thanks so much, Jesse.
Absolutely.
Appreciate it.
Absolute pleasure.
That's it. Hey everybody, Chris here again. Thanks so much for tuning into the entire podcast this week. Really appreciate it. If you guys liked it, leave me a comment in YouTube if you're watching this on YouTube, and leave a review on podcast. It really helps me. If you want to leave a comment, please do. Like, I really want feedback on this. You can catch this on YouTube if you don't know. You can watch me record this live in the studio there. You can also get on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and other apps like Overcast and everything are syndicating this automatically. So it's really available wherever you want, however you want to listen to it. I don't mind. Leave me that feedback. If you want to get in touch with me directly, you can hit me up on Instagram at ChrisHallNYC. You can also email me Chris@Kickster.com. And if you want to know more about me and what I do, I'm an entrepreneur myself and own companies and do, you know, tech, fashion, music, and a whole other bunch of things. You can check out my website, which is just myname.nyc, which is ChrisHall.nyc. Again, thanks so much for listening. Feel free to get in touch with me. I love to talk with you guys, and I'll see you guys in the next episode. Appreciate it and have a good one.